Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Oh, hi, I didn't see you there. Welcome to the show. Before we get started, I urge you to go to our Patreon page at bobseskashow.com right now and sign up for our $10 a month level to get both the Shadow Docket bonus show and our Friday after party shows with me and Kimberly Johnson. Specifically, if you want to hear what it sounds like when I totally lose my schmodoinkle, the after party from Friday, October 8th is the place to be. Again, that's bobseskashow.com or patreon.com/bobseskashow. Choose the after party and Shadow Docket level, enter your information, and you're all set. By the way, there's an app for listening and an RSS feed if you're into those things too. Thanks so much for supporting this podcast. And now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
I protest. I am not a merry man.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, October 13, 2021, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, how you doing? My name is Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, day 267 of the Biden-Harris administration, 392 days until the 22 midterms. Find me on Instagram, as usual, at TheBobSeska, and on Twitter at BobSeska_go. So I had an amazing chat with my friend Ben Cohen today, and we'll have that for you here in just a second. Ben, of course, is the publisher of the Banter newsletter, thebanter.substack.com, where I write a weekly column every Thursday, full disclosure. And Ben's the former publisher of The Daily Banter, the political opinion site Chez and I wrote for back in the day. Ben and I have been working together since, since the 2000s. And he supported my writing career more than just about anyone else I know. So today we talked about the fuckery at Facebook, how online publications can navigate all the insanity in politics these days. Oh, and by the way, stick around for the part where we talk about Ben's experiences with psychedelics. Meantime, if you can, please help support this show by subscribing to our bonus content at bobseskashow.com. Okay, here comes me and the great Ben Cohen. So how far along is Betsy? Is she doing well? Everything's going smoothly?
Yeah, she everything seems to be okay. We're 8 months in, almost to the day, in fact. It's 8 months today.
So wow.
We've got 4 weeks left. We're just trying to desperately scramble to get the house ready.
Yeah.
For everything, like make a bedroom and blah blah blah. So we're all behind, and Moses has decided that he's not going to let us sleep at all.
Moses, yeah.
At all. Yeah, he's been a bit better for the last couple of days, but so finally we both feel like we can actually get some stuff done, but it's like a bit of a last minute scramble.
Why isn't he letting you guys sleep? Is that a protest? Is he interrupting your sleep because he doesn't want a brother or sister coming along?
He seems to be excited about it. Like,
oh, good.
He does seem about it, but I think he knows something's about to change, and he's also started Montessori, so you know that's kind of like it's a big change, it's a big thing for him.
Yeah,
you know? So kids are weird, you know. Kids are like, you know, he has dreams, you know. He thinks there are for a while he's been thinking there were penguins in his room that were coming out of the cupboard.
Oh man, really, penguins?
Yeah, penguins in the cupboard. You know, had long chats with them about shadows, that shadows are just, you know, how what a shadow is and that it's just light.
Oh, my God.
You know, this kind of stuff. It's like, yeah.
So, you know, I mention this all the time, but one of my favorite things on social media are your videos with Moses, where you're talking to Moses and he's just communicating something to you, or you're just evaluating what trouble he's gotten into. Like, I think of the time he had hummus in his hair. You're asking him about the hummus. And then he tore apart that big hunk of styrofoam. And thought it was snow or something like that. It just, your commentary with his just utter cuteness is so goddamn entertaining, Ben.
Well, I'm glad that other people find it entertaining. We often don't when he's pulled all the dirt out of the plant pots and swept it all over the floor. And looks up as if like, what? I haven't done anything. Thanks for doing this at 6 a.m. We really appreciate it.
Oh my God, though. Talk about a kid though, who was tailor-made for social media. I mean, that guy, that guy, so it was like a buddy from the pub, right? that kid is so photogenic.
We have a new one. We have a new one coming as well. So hopefully that, you know, we can provide more entertainment. We haven't really done, we haven't put much of Moses on social media recently, but who knows? I think just because we've been sleep deprived.
Yeah.
We haven't had any sleep for a month.
Well, what happened between you and Instagram? There was some sort of dust up between, you were posting these videos and then Instagram was what, taking them down or something? What was going on with the Moses videos?
I don't know. I don't know whether it was banter related or something. I had went after someone in, you know, I have a conspiratorial theory on this, that I went after someone who's quite a kind of like mover and shaker in the new age supplement wellness world.
Yeah.
I wrote a big piece on it. I don't know if you remember that piece. I went after a guy, he's one of Joe Rogan's friends and has supplement empire. And he'd been posting conspiracy theories and anti-vax stuff. I went after him. And interestingly, like a couple of days later, he blocked me on Instagram. And then all of a sudden I got banned from Instagram.
Oh my God. So do you think maybe he reported you or something, or was this separate? I mean, did you ever get to the bottom of why exactly you were banned from Instagram?
I don't know. I couldn't find out. I suspect my conspiracy theory is that he is like, maybe he knows someone at Facebook or Instagram and he had them take me down. I don't know.
Jesus.
It was weird that there were, you know, it was a series of events. It seemed like a kind of, I don't know if it was a coincidence or not, but the timing was a little suspicious that this guy blocked me. Then like a day later, I get taken off of Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I was that, I don't know, who knows. But I managed to get a contact. So I have a contact at Facebook through a friend, mm-hmm. and they got me reinstated. Someone I could get hold of, someone who works at the Death Star.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that seems to be the only avenue of recourse if you're kicked off of Facebook or completely banned from Facebook. I mean, certainly it's one thing to be banned for 30 days and to come back, but a lot of people are kicked off permanently and there's really no one to talk to, no one to protest to, unless you happen to know someone. And that's one of the many frustrations about dealing with that platform. And it keeps getting worse and worse, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I think they need to regulate, like your piece the other week was, they need to be very, very strictly regulated. It's too big, too powerful, too opaque, you know?
Yeah.
There's no way of holding them accountable. I mean, yeah, it was literally just by luck that I managed to get myself reinstated.
Right, right. And you know what? I think there's a new push going on. There's been some mention recently about regulating the algorithm specifically. In fact, there was a piece on MSN today, and the headline was "Lawmakers' Latest Idea to Fix Facebook, Regulate the Algorithm," which I think is a phenomenal idea. That's the source, I think, of all of our headaches, right? I think that's the centerpiece of it.
Yeah, regulate the algorithm, because I mean that's what took us down. They we went down because of the algorithm. They tweaked the algorithm. We had no say over it. We got no say over this whatsoever. No consultation, no forewarning. Just all of a sudden, 80% of your traffic gone.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like nearly every time there's a new revelation about Zuckerberg and Facebook, I think about how the Daily Banter has been screwed by that goddamn algorithm. I mean, as a publisher of a political website and now a political newsletter, it must be especially infuriating to watch as Facebook cuts off the blood supply of traffic to the banter over the years. It's happened numerous times. I mean, I go all the way back to 2013 when I first noticed it happening. As we used to post, I mean, those of you who are unaware by way of background, we would post something on the Daily Banter and cross-promote it on Facebook, and Facebook alone would generate hundreds of thousands of views to that piece. I mean, incoming traffic to thedailybanter.com from Facebook. And then suddenly, it was in the fall of 2013, somewhere around there. I remember specifically, it was like someone turned off the power. It just stopped. And I think it was a change in the algorithm, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely was. I mean, we used to get shared by, you know, Bill Maher used to read our stuff and he used to share it on Facebook. We used to crash the site. We were routinely going down because Bill Maher would share something and, you know, a million people would come on the site. But now I'm pretty certain that Bill Maher doesn't get to see any of our stuff in his newsfeed.
Right.
Because the algorithm has changed and therefore we don't show up and, you know, he doesn't share it. And even if he did share it, you know, these days it wouldn't really do that much.
Yeah.
You know, it would have little effect. Our Facebook page has barely grown in 4 years. It hasn't really grown at all.
Yep. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't grow it because Facebook has decided in their infinite wisdom that political content is, they don't want people reading about politics. I don't really understand it. I genuinely do not understand their thinking. It makes no sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, partly because I see all kinds of political content on Facebook that gets circulated. I mean, every goddamn day, or I should say every week, there's a new list of the top posts on Facebook pages, and they're all like either Dan Bongino or Ben Shapiro. I mean, I'm talking literally maybe 9 out of 10 are Trump supporters. And yet at the same time, we experience this dynamic where you post something on Facebook, especially something that maybe, dare I say, mentions Facebook itself or Zuckerberg in a political context, that gets entirely buried. And it's got to be, Ben, a matter of paying for that kind of reach. I'm sure, like the Daily Wire, for example, or the Bongino people. I guess Bongino has people somehow. They pay for their reach, don't they?
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that from what I understand, Facebook weights, the algorithm is weighted towards pieces that stir up emotion.
Yeah.
Right? You know, what stirs up emotion better than right-wing propaganda?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, is as in what right-wing propaganda, right-wing quote-unquote news is essentially, it's clickbait. And clickbait works less than it used to, but it works quite well with right-wing audiences because, you know, let's not beat around the bush here. They're not quite as educated as liberal audiences.
Right.
So left-wing conspiracy theories are are real and they happen. And there's a lot of clickbait nonsense on, you know, on the left and in liberal kind of, world, right? We've seen a lot of that, but there's a qualitative difference between, you know, what we would regard as kind of clickbaity, right? And then you compare that with what you're seeing on from the right, from Breitbart, from all these other right-wing sites and AM hate radio, where it's just kind of nonsense, absolute gibberish. And you think, how does anyone with a brain cell read that and think that this is real, think that this is, but there are genuinely people who swallow it hook, line and sinker.
Yeah.
So I think that there is a difference between right and left wing clickbait. And, but yeah, again, Facebook is, it's weighted, like the algorithm favors that kind of content, you know?
Yeah.
Any right-wing website that you go on or Facebook page, it's just, it's full of hatred and, you know, they've, I'll give it to them, they're passionate about their hatred, but, you know, it's not ethical, that's for sure. There's no reason behind it. I don't think Facebook is definitely not doing the right thing.
Well, it seems like the way the algorithm is set up, it actually kind of benefits people who game the algorithm. And you were mentioning clickbait a second ago. I've noticed some opinion aggregators, I'm not going to mention any names here, but on the left, for that matter, that still rake in traffic from Facebook. But the problem is they play fast and loose with the truth on top of being loaded with clickbait. I mean, you know, the reputable publishers are completely unwilling to do that, and we end up getting screwed as a consequence of it, don't we?
Right. I mean, that was our whole mission statement. But remember, we're back in the day, you, Chez, and I, and the rest of the gang.
Yeah.
That was what we sort of did. We spent all of our time beating back right-wing propaganda and misinformation as best we could, despite all of the incentives to do otherwise, despite the incentives to, you know. But I think that's also why people have were actually willing to pay to read us as well. Like, I don't think had we launched a paid version of the site, of the banter, that anyone would have actually given us any money had we engaged in that kind of stuff. So, you know, I do like to think that by sticking to by being ethical, at least we have, you know, we have smart readers who really value our content, even though we are consistently screwed by Facebook and social media in general.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the great irony is that they're using this algorithm at Facebook. They're setting policy at Facebook to prevent this kind of content from spreading, the really incendiary, sometimes radicalizing content. But at the same time, all they seem to be doing in reality is encouraging that sort of thing. It seems like every day we read another story about how Facebook is radicalizing people, whether it's through the insurrection or with anti-vax things. And it seems like that kind of content is always rising to the surface, despite what Facebook says publicly, which indicates to me that maybe Facebook isn't doing such a good job of beating it down, or that it's actually encouraging it. And going back to like Ben Shapiro, I remember reading about how you know, the Daily Wire doing all of these side deals with Facebook to allow them to break the same rules that get other people kicked off the platform.
Right. And I think the only way to avoid this is, so like you said, Bob, like in your piece last week on the newsletter, is that it has to be regulated by the government, by an independent body. They certainly can't be trusted to self-regulate. Number one. Number two, publishers, I don't know what the hell reputable publishers are supposed to do anymore, other than go to email, which is what we've done, which where the algorithm can't mess with. Even we're still at the kind of, you know, we're still screwed by Facebook. We still rely on Facebook to get traffic, to expose people to the newsletter, and we're still being screwed by them. But we're being screwed less, because we're not so dependent. Our distribution method is via email rather than via any social media feed.
Yeah.
So I don't know what people are supposed to do. I really don't. Like, I think it's a really, publishers are in a real bind, and you know, like people who actually spend a lot of time crafting quality content are just, yeah, they get screwed. It's not good for society either, right? It's not good for democracy, not good for society, not good for publishing. Mm-hmm. You know, a bad company.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And people might ask, and I get this question occasionally, Ben, was, why are you busily chasing after Facebook? What's the appeal? Why do you need Facebook at all? And all you need to do is look at the numbers where traffic ends up coming from. Unfortunately, you know, we'd like to think, well, if we just put all of our eggs in the Twitter basket, for example, then we'll get the same amount of traffic. Well, it doesn't work that way. For some reason, people click on things from Facebook way more often than they do on Twitter. Is that still a thing? Because I remember that's been a dynamic in the past, and I admittedly haven't looked at my own numbers recently as far as that goes. So I don't know. Is Facebook still like the golden ring? Is that the thing that we all are seeking out because it actually does generate more traffic than the other social media platforms?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, the Twitter is most people retweet things they haven't read.
Yeah.
Right. So because I think the platform kind of encourages this sort of short form interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, you're not going to Facebook is it's slower. You're on there for longer. You actually might read, you know, the posts are longer. So you'll kind of read more carefully what people are saying. You know, not all the time, but at least more of the time than on Twitter.
Yeah.
I have spent a lot more time on Twitter, right? But no matter how much time I've spent on Twitter, the majority of the traffic still comes from Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just the reality of it. And, you know, so just enough so that we have to pay attention to them, just enough so that we have to stay on the bloody platform.
You know, it seems like there are fewer and fewer platforms for promoting a site or a podcast for that matter. I mean, have you heard any encouraging news behind the scenes as far as some sort of thing to come along that would be, you know, maybe equivalent to the kind of traffic that Facebook used to generate, but is not Facebook?
You know what? The only platform that I have seen any genuine hope for is something called Discord. I don't know how familiar you are with Discord.
I've heard of it. I'm not familiar with exactly what it is.
So Discord is kind of interesting. Discord is like a kind of, I think it's like Slack, although I never really used Slack. Mm-hmm. It's basically a platform where you sign up, you join, and you can join these, basically they're kind of like rooms, right? And they're just messenger rooms. And there are these enormous communities that get built on Discord that you can go and participate in, right? And you can chat to the owners, you can host audio events through Discord. You can post links, you can post articles, there's a whole load of things that you can do on Discord that are quite interesting. And, you know, I only sort of found out about it because I was invited to a Discord channel and I thought it was really interesting. and you can join lots of different rooms. So I definitely recommend, you know, people checking that out. It doesn't work quite like Facebook.
Yeah.
But you can build communities there and there are no algorithms. They're basically private. That's the only thing that I've seen, and I've experimented a lot more with Discord in recent time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one where I would, you know, I would certainly think about, you know, putting some effort into. That's my analysis thus far. All the other ones, MeWe and Elo and all that kind of stuff, I think they're kind of Facebook knockoffs, and they won't really catch on.
Yeah.
But I think Discord is really where it's at. It's kind of like Facebook groups, but Facebook groups, again, like you're not, you know, whether you see what's happening in Facebook groups depends on how Facebook is feeling that day. Does Facebook want you to see what's in Facebook groups that day? You know, maybe they do, maybe they don't, you know, that's the thing. So yeah, that's Discord. That's what I think is a good thing for publishers to invest time in.
It seems like we talk a lot about regulation. We're talking about the algorithm and so on, regulating that. But there is one other solution beyond either regulating it or getting people to leave Facebook or Facebook just shutting down entirely. There is kind of a fourth solution that I didn't mention in my piece last week, which is some sort of thing to come along to replace Facebook. It's happened many times in the past, and all it takes is a little bit of innovation and a great idea, something brand new that maybe people haven't even thought about yet in terms of, because I don't think anyone thought of what Twitter was before Twitter. It's such an unusual platform for conversation. But with Facebook, it seems like there ought to be something to come along. Give it a serious run for its money. Whether it's something Apple does or there's got to be something that all at once does the things we want it to do. And at the same time, doesn't have all of the bullshit lumped on top of it, the data mining and the predatory behavior and all the rest of it. Just it's confounding that that hasn't happened yet.
I think inevitably that will happen. Yeah, right? There's going to be something that comes along where everyone just says, oh, okay, yeah, this makes a lot more sense. And they go, I mean, this is why Facebook, you know, bought WhatsApp. This is why Facebook bought Instagram. Mm-hmm. They don't have any ideas themselves. It's a, you know, I think they're just trying to buy up the competition as fast as possible.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that something will come along. It will be too nimble, too fast. People will adopt it very quickly. And that'll be it.
Yeah. You know, I was noticing today, Ben, that 13 of the top 20 news shows on Apple Podcasts were all hosted by or are all hosted by Trump supporters or conservatives. Two of those 13 are Wall Street Journal podcasts. So that's where I put in the conservative category. Everything else, Trump supporters of those 13. I suspect there's a similar ratio for online publications. I mean, granted, my observation is narrow, but why does it seem as if liberals don't consume as much online media as Trumpers? Otherwise, these numbers would be a little bit different. They'd be more skewed toward the left than they are to the right. You know what I mean?
So I think there's probably several reasons behind that, and some of which we've discussed, and the fact that conservative content, at least in America, it's inherently disingenuous. It's inherently manipulative, and not, you know, again, while they're apparent that, you know, it's not to say that the left doesn't do this, but not to the same extent. Not to the same extent like the right-wing media. I mean, take, you know, Trump's, you know, January 6th and the way that the right-wing media basically covered it for a few days and then said, right, we will need to move on. It wasn't actually that bad. You know, this is a guy who instigated a coup.
Yeah.
He tried to literally like end democracy in America via a violent coup,
mm-hmm.
right? And the right-wing media just swept it under the carpet. And I think that this basically this fundamental dishonesty means that you are much freer than to create any kind of content you want. It's like Tucker Carlson. There was a fantastic piece on Tucker Carlson by, I think it was Alex Shepard in the New Republic. And he talked about how Tucker Carlson essentially found out that he, you know, he ran the Daily Caller. Back in the day, the Daily Caller was actually reasonably kind of reputable, right? They took, you know, and Tucker Carlson spoke about this, about wanting to have a kind of an honest news company, right?
Yeah.
But he quickly found out that nobody cared. Nobody gave a flying F-U-C-K about having honest news on the right. So he abandoned it. And then, you know, Tucker Carlson was a complete failure. Everywhere he's been a failure until he became like a right-wing, you know, demagogue, right? But until he became a kind of racist fascist, right? So he knows his audience. He knows what to say in order to get the clicks, in order to get the views, right? So his entire life, he's been searching for this one, you know, circus act. He's mm-hmm. found the circus act, right? Which is be basically lying on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And he's the number one talk show host in America. He's the number one news show in America now, mm-hmm. right? Tucker Carlson is the most, you know, he's untouchable, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think this is sort of indicative of, or representative rather, of right-wing media as a whole,
mm-hmm.
where it doesn't even bother self-regulating. Like at least the left, liberal media tries, at least attempts to do, they attempt to do good journalism. You say CNN and Fox News are, you know, basically both are just as bad as the other, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just not true. It's just not true. CNN at least takes itself seriously. CNN at least bothers to fact check, bothers to correct itself when it makes mistakes, bothers to not put racist, fear mongers like Tucker Carlson, you know, on primetime shows, right?
Yeah.
So as a result, I think that you're going to see the audience size there's just more people. Like it's easier to generate viewers if you have controversial content. So, and that's the same podcast, TV, the news, you know.
Okay, short break. Back with more Ben Cohen right after these words.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
The Bob Seska Show.
The needle I've been trying to thread for years, Ben, is how do you present reputable content, whether it's articles, podcasts, what have you, and still generate those kind of downloads while avoiding the clickbait and bullshit and lies? That's a difficult ask, I think. And maybe that's cynical of me to say that, but seems like the temptation is that you get more warm bodies looking at your material if you're engaging in the bullshit end-arounds, the truth. You know, or you, if you're just feeding people bullshit, it seems like that gets the clicks. But how do you get people to click on things that are, you know, informative and based on factual reality? It seems like an uphill climb.
It's an uphill climb, right? I mean, I'm sure, yeah. just like me, there are days when you think like, I don't know what else I need to do here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, in fact, Stephanie Miller and I have this conversation all the time where we say, you know, look, we're grinding it out in the trenches of liberal conversation, and it would be very easy to make millions of dollars a year if we just sold out our values and became conservatives. And so many of the personalities that we know about, that we have name recognition of on the far right, are people who simply sold out their values and became conservatives. I've seen it all over the place when it comes to radio guys, too. Morning radio guys looking for a place that they can still talk on the radio, on broadcast radio. And the only outlet for that is to become an AM radio talk show screecher. And so that's an immensely frustrating aspect of all of this, is, you know, maintaining a firm grasp on your values while at the same time trying to generate an audience.
Yeah, no, I think that that's absolutely, 100% correct. You know, if you don't stick to your guns on this, you become as bad as them.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right. You become about a you know, and then what do you wake up and then you're Tucker Carlson, right? Think about how that guy feels, yeah, as you know what I mean, as a human being. Right. Tucker Carlson has to wake up every morning and realize that that's what his career has culminated in.
Yeah.
It culminated in him becoming a racist, right? Becoming a fear-mongering racist demagogue, right? It's shameful. And I think there are no ways out of this other than to stick to your guns. Yeah. There's no other way. You know, we have to keep doing what we're doing. We have to just accept the fact that, you know, you can't reach out to right-wing audiences. They're too far gone, mm-hmm, right? I don't even know how you would begin to do that. How, yeah, do you begin to even, like, you know, how do you begin to even reach out to people who are stuck in that world, stuck, mm-hmm, in that ecosystem of absolute insanity, right? And yeah, I don't know. I mean, you could do clickbait. I mean, but the problem is, again, that you end up becoming what you hate. You end,
yeah,
up,
yeah,
not telling the truth. You end up saying things that aren't real, that aren't, and then your audience, like anybody who's got half a brain, will see through it, and they're not going to stick around, mm-hmm, you know? And then you have all you have is a clickbait machine, which is basically what BuzzFeed was. BuzzFeed just became, but then you look what they did. BuzzFeed invested millions and millions into having real reporters, investigative journalists come on board to revive the brand.
Yep.
And I don't even know how profitable that is. I really don't. Maybe it's, I don't, you know, I'm sure they don't make, I'm sure their news section isn't that profitable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That, I would guess that it's not anywhere near as profitable as all the celebrity stuff that they do, or the video stuff that they do. Mm-hmm. You know, that they, you know, so that's why we are basically, we're reliant on our subscribers.
Yeah. I mean, that's the pisser of it too, Ben. Like with BuzzFeed as an example, that they have to engage in all the clickbait bullshit, you know, with the listicles and all the rest of it, in order to finance the journalism side, you know, because the journalism side isn't generating the revenue. It's almost like Edward R. Murrow used to have to do like ridiculous celebrity interviews so he could do the really hard hitting stuff. You know what I mean? And that was the only way to make it financially feasible, which is just, you know, I look at this from an idealistic point of view and I go, why does it have to be that way? But it just is. And
it just is. But like, you know, I think like, for example, you know, your podcast and what we do at the Banter, I like to think that it's pretty good. It's entertaining as well. You know, like there's some personality there. Mm-hmm. You know, that people will check in and read us because they, you know, it's not like reading, I don't know, ProPublica or reading the BBC, right? You know, there's some personality behind it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's what differentiates us. And that's what I do think that's what gives us kind of such a loyal audience as we have.
Well, one of the things that has blown me away, something I learned about in the past year or two that I wasn't aware of prior, was buying downloads, buying shares, buying retweets and likes and follows, where there is now an industry that has built up online where you can buy your internet reach, you can buy your social media reach. And prior to hearing about this, I was aware of the fact that conservatives often would bulk have their books, have their publications bulk purchased by financiers, and then that would elevate their status on the New York Times bestseller list, certainly on the Amazon list and some of the other online bestseller lists. That, of course, is immensely unfair. It's absolutely cheating. It's almost like steroids for online media. You think about steroids in sports. Well, this is like steroids in online publishing, when people can just go and buy their visibility. And I sometimes look at people like Ben Shapiro or Dan Bongino or even Steven Crowder and wonder, where do they get this popularity? Where do they get this visibility? And I'm like, oh, it could be that they're buying their reach. Now, I don't know. I don't have any facts along those lines. I don't know exactly that they're doing that, but this is something that conservatives have done in the past. And so I have to kind of look at them with a little bit of a side eye. When 13, as I said before, 13 of the top 20 news shows on Apple Podcasts are Trump supporters, I wonder, where's that coming from? And then I do a search on podcast, buying podcast downloads, and sure as shit, there's a website out there where you can buy downloads for your podcast and buy the hundreds, if not thousands, and it's relatively inexpensive. That kind of shit goes on. I mean, does that ever make you want to just hang it up and go, you know, how the hell do I compete against this now?
Yeah, you just, right. Of course, you know, of course it does. And it means that those with more money, those with big pockets, deep pockets, they have a leg up.
Yeah.
Right. And the small independent media publishers are just left, you know, to fend for themselves without being able to do any of this stuff. I mean, it's certainly unfair. It's inherently unfair.
Yeah.
And it makes me sometimes hate the publishing industry. I absolutely hate it. You know, and I obviously love what I do, but I don't like the industry that I work in. You know, I think that it's, the priorities are completely backwards. The internet has done, you know, it's been amazing and terrible at the same time. It's been like so many challenges, and it's dominated by all the big tech companies, by Facebook, by Apple, by, you know, so for example, in the newsletter, Apple has just decided that they are going to block, you know, there are ways to find out how many people have read like emails, for example. So we send our email newsletter out. We can see, you know, how many people have opened it. Apple just decided we're going to stop that.
Yeah.
Right. I get it. There are privacy issues, but I think that people should be able to opt in or out of that. If you don't want some, you know, there are ways you can do that. But Apple just made a decision to essentially wreck newsletter publishers' ability to know whether anybody's reading their newsletter.
Jesus.
Right. So it's just another kind of like, you know, another big tech decision that what this will do is it will, you know, we don't have the money, for example, we don't have the money to innovate our way out of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We innovation for us is basically, you know, just working as hard as we can to make as good content as we can. That's it. That's the game that we have. That's the only thing that we can do, is keep creating good content and hope that people see it and read it and hear it, and that they support us. That's it. That's what we've got left.
You know, one of the things I grapple with in this story about Apple certainly contributes to my view that when we're dealing with third-party platforms like Substack, for example, Patreon, in my case, knowing that it's ultimately their turf, ultimately we're at the mercy of these third parties, Facebook, etc. Is that ever a concern for you in terms of the business model with the banter? I mean, I think about this every damn day, that ultimately my income, 99% of it comes through our Patreon page. And but Patreon could disappear any day and I'd be completely screwed with my pants on. Does that ever factor into your planning and your sense of security with building your business using a platform like Substack?
Yeah, it does. I mean, the thing about Substack I quite like about Substack is that I own all of the data. Yeah. So I can take all of the subscribers and go somewhere. There are other competitors to Substack. So I'm able, and I wouldn't sign up for a company, a platform that wouldn't allow me to do that. So I am able to take them all and go somewhere else. You know, but yeah, of course, you know, you're dependent on this technology that's owned, you know, by venture capitalists, right, to reach your audience, and they can take it away. What they give, they can take.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm only interested really in so that's why I moved to Substack, because I thought, okay, look, they can't take it away from me. They can't stop me from sending emails.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, Apple's doing their bit now, but generally speaking, like, they can't stop me sending emails. It's the oldest technology on the web, right? Email. I mean, it's the original way of like reaching people.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So that's the right. And I can take all of my subscribers away, all the banter subscribers that we have, I can go somewhere else, right, to another platform and plug and play straight away.
That's great. Yeah.
Won't know any different. Mm. So that's really the only, you know, I had a huge, even though it really hurt us when we moved, right, it was very difficult. We don't run any ads on the newsletter. So we have zero ad revenue. It's all subscriber revenue. So, you know, that was very, very painful, but there was a bit of a relief when it's like, okay, they can't really take any more from me. Mm-hmm. Like, I've just had years and years and years. We had years of it, years and years and years of being screwed by Facebook.
Yeah.
Screwed by, you know, We got screwed by a paywall company. They just decided, right, we're going to put our percentage up. We're gonna increase our revenue share.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They decided, right. But I couldn't move the subscribers off because they were signed up through PayPal and there were all these problems with it. It was, you know, it was terrible. It was what an awful, you know, but so finally moving to Substack, I'm like, okay, they cannot touch this. They cannot.
Yeah.
Like, everyone signs up, it goes through Stripe. Stripe is the banter, like that's our information. No one can take that away from us. Mm-hmm. So I feel hugely, even though it's really difficult and we've lost a lot of our revenue, you know, it's better than the alternative.
Yeah, and you probably know there was a controversy maybe earlier in the summer, earlier this year, about Substack paying substantial advances to certain publishers. What was your take on all of that?
I mean, I get it. I get why they did that. I get why they had to get, they had some VC money. Mm-hmm. And this is a way of competing with the big boys, I guess. They're a full on media company now.
Yeah.
It does feel kind of sucks a bit. It's like, okay, we're a mid-sized publisher. We need help too. Be nice if somebody invested in us as well. We have a proven track record, but
yeah,
again, no, you know, that's okay. I see what they're doing. I'd rather Substack was successful and kept putting money into innovation and making the platform better than not. So I wasn't too upset by that.
Yeah.
I thought that it was, you know, wasn't too bad, but yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I think Substack is a decent company.
What kind of conditions would have to fall into place for the dailybanter.com to come back as an active website? Is group logs ever going to, you know, kind of swing back around and become trendy again? Or is it kind of that day has passed?
You know what? I think maybe at least for now, that day is past. You never know, yeah. You know, swings and roundabouts. Who knew that email was going to be the
right and GIFs? It was like, I remember in the 90s, first starting on the internet, and it was all about email newsletters and GIFs. And now it's like everything is GIFs and email newsletters 20 years later. More like 25 years later. It's amazing.
So, yeah, who knows? I mean, who knows? I mean, there are some interesting developments happening in that world, particularly with advertising, for example, and the way that the game is changing completely. But the deal would have to be, you know, basically what we saw was advertising companies, just the slow erosion of ad rates over time. From Facebook, also from other ad networks. The ad game is a complete mess, an unregulated disaster. And I'm very glad not to have to participate in that anymore.
Right.
I think it's getting better, you know, but for it to happen, for us to do that, there'd have to be a lot of changes in the industry for that to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, it was great, you know, writing for the Banter was great fun. I mean, we talked shit all week, Bob, didn't we? That's what we did.
Yeah, exactly. I think we had such a great dynamic between you and me and Chez. And then there was a great attitude about it that I don't think was duplicated anywhere else. I think we had a unique view on everything that set us apart.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think so. I think it lives on in your podcast. I think it lives on in the Banter newsletter. Mm-hmm. But there's never going to be, you know, I don't think, yeah, replicating that again is no one could do what we did.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, obviously you found some great writers as far as the newsletter goes, with Justin Rosario contributing. He's, talk about someone who, no one can fill Chez's shoes, but Justin steps in and fills a gap, I think, in terms of style and approach that maybe you and I don't have, that I think rounds out the personalities on the newsletter really well.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so. It's great fun reading when Justin goes on. I have to talk with Justin every week. I'm like, Justin, this is too angry. We need to tone this down.
All right. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that you've written about in the recent past has been psychedelics. How did you end up sort of stepping into that entire universe? I think you took a trip to South America at some point. Tell me about all of that.
Oh, yeah. I went down to Peru
in
2015 and did 4 ayahuasca ceremonies. God knows why I did that. People ask me, why did I do that? And I genuinely don't know. I genuinely couldn't tell you why that appealed to me, but it did. Mm. It really did appeal. I don't know why. I'd never taken any psychedelics in my life. I never smoked weed. I never smoked cigarettes, never took LSD, never did literally nothing as a teenager. You know, I drank beer as most kids do in the UK. And very cheap liquor. But that was it. I don't know. I just decided to, it was fascinating. And I went down to try it out and it was absolutely terrifying.
What was it? Describe the experience. So, and what hallucinogen or what psychedelic you guys were using at that point in time. And then what did you see? What did you feel?
So I don't know. Do you have any experience? I don't know if you want to divulge this.
No, I actually don't. I've smoked plenty of pot for sure. I've drank, but that's the kind of the extent for me. I mean, I had some speed in college. I sound so lame, but yeah, that's really the spectrum of things that I've taken. Yeah.
More adventurous than me. That's way more adventurous than me. So I went down to the jungle and did the most potent psychedelic brew known to man.
Wow.
It is. It's incredibly powerful ayahuasca. Like I can't even convey like that how extreme the experience is of when drinking ayahuasca. It's got a substance called dimethyltryptamine in, which is DMT. And DMT is the most potent psychedelic compound known to man.
Wow.
And my experience of it was to be blasted into a completely separate reality. You know, shocking. I was shocked, to say the least. I, you know, there are no other words to describe it other than profound shock at being in one place, ingesting this kind of what looked like brown sludge with some indigenous Peruvians in a tent in the middle of the rainforest, and then being blasted into what appeared to be a different reality. It was absolutely frightening.
So what distinguished the separate reality from our actual reality? I mean, what were you seeing?
So, well, the first thing that I saw was, it's going to sound very strange, but the first thing that I saw was what appeared to me to look like an alien. So, which obviously I hadn't really been prepared for that, to see an alien.
No, I can imagine. I'm in the Peruvian rainforest and there's an alien standing there in front of me now. Yeah.
There's an alien in front of me with what looked like a huge probe on its arm.
Ah! Wow.
Yeah. And so at that point I started to kind of freak out and bang on the floor and hope that someone was going to come. There were helpers there as well. There were Western helpers. So I was banging on the floor to like get someone to help me. But then it's so strong that I was going in and out of two different, like this reality and wherever else I was in, I don't know what that was. But yeah, I just disappeared into this other realm and there was an alien in front of me. And then I experienced this alien going through my spine. I could see through the probe into my spine. And I could see all these pain points on my spine I have a condition called fibromyalgia, which is like a pretty bad pain condition.
Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah.
It's pretty bad. Like when the weather changes and there's, you know, certain, I don't know, food substances can trigger it and things like that.
Yeah.
I get migraines as well. But whatever this was, it appeared to know that. And then pinpoint these points on my spine that were related to this migraines and whatever condition I had, fibromyalgia. And then it began to dismantle my perspective on reality. So I felt I saw all these pain points like lighting up, and this alien kind of just in looking at me as there were like, then there were more aliens. There were like two or three aliens and they were looking at me like, okay, here's another one. What's he doing here? Let's put him on the table and have a look at him.
Wow.
Then it proceeded to all I can, the next 5 hours was me fighting tooth and nail to stop this from happening.
Yeah.
I just could not accept what was happening. I was like, this is not happening. There's no way that this is possible, that this is happening.
Yeah.
And this is way too personal. I thought I was just coming down to have a kind of, you know, it would be a bit like, I don't know. I don't even know what I thought it would be like, but not like that.
Do you still grapple with that? Like remembering what you were seeing and wondering, was I just hallucinating this or was I seeing into a different dimension of reality? I mean, that would be the thing that would plague me for the rest of my life. I would constantly be second guessing what I saw for good or bad, positive or negative, because one part of me would be going, maybe I saw something real. Maybe this particular psychedelic, maybe the DMT caused me to see into another dimension. Maybe that's really how things work. Has that been a point of thought for you since then?
Yes. Yes. I think so. You know, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the thing is that reality was more real than this reality. And that's the worst thing about it, right?
Holy shit.
It was infinitely more real than this reality. So it was sort of like I'd been almost, you know, like the movie Avatar, right?
Yeah.
Avatar's kind of like, it was sort of that concept that I'm in an avatar right now, but my real self exists somewhere else. And I went there.
Yeah.
With on ayahuasca, like I, that's where I went back. I went back to. I got a glimpse of like where the real me resides, and it's not here.
Yeah.
It's somewhere else. And it just went on for hours and hours and hours and hours. And I just thought this is never going to end. And it just, I felt like I was being tortured, tortured until I gave in.
Yeah.
So I quit at one point. I was like, okay, I think I'm dead. I had to literally accept my own death. Where I thought, okay, I've fought as hard as I can. I can't fight any longer. I guess I'm dead, and I'm going back to wherever I came from.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I did that, the experience became, it was like someone had lifted a weight off my chest, and I like let go of like, you know, 10 years of anxiety or emotions and anger and things like that. And I felt this sort of sense that there was some kind of whatever it was just kind of saying to me, okay, there you go, you little monkey, boy, and, you know, part of the whole ayahuasca experience is doing something called purging, right? So you kind of like vomit, right? So you vomit out, but it's not necessarily, there's no necessarily substance there.
Yeah.
So I vomited into a bucket all night, but there was barely anything in the bucket after I'd finished.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what I was vomiting, but it was maybe they say that it's bad energy or negative emotions that you've carried for a long time. And that's what it felt like. It felt like I had just, I'd released like years and years and years of anger and things like that I hadn't realized I'd been holding on to. And that I'd accepted that I wasn't really in control of much, and that like reality and was a far more complex than I had ever imagined, and that there wasn't really much I could. I had just sit back and enjoy the show rather than try to wrap my monkey mind around it.
Yeah, yeah.
That humans are basically, we know very little. We think we know a lot about what's happening, but we don't. We don't know much at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that was my experience of it. And the shaman who were there, the indigenous people there, they seemed to be completely, they thought it was all very normal.
It's amazing to hear you describe your reaction, because it would have been the same reaction I would have had. I would have fought it. I don't know what that says about my character or your character, but I feel as though I would be so uncomfortable because my brain would be so conflicted and so blown away by that experience that I would want it to end as quickly as possible. And while I've never done any psychedelics, I had one really terrible experience with pot one night, and I got so high that I was having these anxiety attacks. I was actually waffling back and forth between euphoria and utter sheer terror, like I was about to die. And it was so miserable and uncomfortable. Obviously, it was nice when the euphoria would wash over me, but then when the other thing would appear, and it was just back and forth and back and forth between those two extremes, I just wanted it to be over. I couldn't wait for it to be over. Okay, I'm done with this experience. I've lived it enough to be able to tell the story. Now, please be over soon. And it sounds like that was the exact same experience you had, but at the same time, would you recommend that other people try this and to see if they have some of the positive outcomes that you had?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I would say that if what I'm saying, if any of it rings true or resonates with you in any way, then it might be worth looking into. If your immediate reaction is, what the fuck, that is insane, you're crazy, good job, like, you know, thanks for coming back and telling us all about it, but that's a, you know, thanks but no thanks, then it's not for you, you know? Like, it's interesting the reaction that people have had when I've told them about it, because it's about, I would say about 20% of people become interested, and they're like, that's interesting, I'd like to find out more about that.
Mm-hmm.
And all the stuff about purging and seeing aliens doesn't really seem to bother them. They're like, it piques their interest. You know, they become more sort of, they're like, oh, I need to look into this. What is this?
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of them just think I'm crazy. And that I just was hallucinating, and there's, you know, there's nothing more to be said about it. And it's all very scary. And I respect both, you know, I would say that again, if it resonates with you, then look into it more. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, I'm happy to chat more about it. Yep. But there's a lot of information out on the web about it. But yeah, for me, it was hugely beneficial overall. Definitely scary. Definitely took me, it's taken me quite a long time to integrate it and to try to figure out what has happened.
Yeah.
Have
you had any flashbacks? Have you seen that alien again?
No, but I've done other psychedelics. I had three more ayahuasca ceremonies after that. That was just the first one.
Oh my God. Okay.
More. Yeah. Scary. Really
scary every time. It doesn't get less scary.
The third one was less scary because I'd kind of like come to terms with it and was just like, okay, I can't really control it. But and I've gone back and done other things that have been less extreme, but some very challenging times. Like, I don't view it, it's not a fun time, these are regarded as medicine in the Amazon rainforest, and that's how I regard them, as medicine for psychological and some physical ailments, things like that. That's what how it's reviewed on in the rainforest. So that's how I view it. Who knows why I'm interested in this stuff? I can't explain to you. I've got no background in it. My parents think I'm crazy.
You told your parents? You told your folks?
Yeah,
what was their reaction? What did your dad say?
I mean, he just said, "Oh, yeah, that doesn't sound like much fun." And that was about the end of the conversation.
such a British reaction, I think.
Right, exactly. So who, not really, didn't get much support from my family. They just thought I was, they'd like, okay, he's gone off to do psychedelics in the rainforest. Don't really know how to, there was, what's not in their kind of paradigm. It's not within their kind of, they have no reference point. They nothing to go on to even relate to me. I understand that. I understand that. I sympathize. I found it immensely helpful. I think I have integrated it, and I've come to terms with the fact that I had no idea what happened or how it can be explained. Deep down, I think that these substances, that we are, our brains run on chemicals, and if you change those chemicals, what we see is different and no less real than this real. It's just different. It's just a different interpretation of what we're seeing now. I think that's my view on it. And there's a whole other kind of reality and way of organizing reality that other cultures have, a lot more experience than we do, and they're fine with it. They call it the spirit world. Whatever you want to call it, I don't care what you call it, but I think that it's equally as real. But do I think that, it doesn't mean that I think that this reality is not real. Like, this is all real too.
Yeah.
It's all real. It's just different. It's like someone switches out the operating board, and you see something different, like a bat.
It's incredible.
Would see
things.
Yeah, a bat would experience reality very differently than we would, right? Everything is, it builds an image of reality through sonar. So likewise, you take a hallucinogen, you're seeing something, it's not necessarily not real. It's just not.
See, I would absolutely insist that I was looking into the multiverse or something. I'm just seeing these are other dimensions layered on top of ours, and so that's how it goes. That's the way the universe is built, and here we are. So that would be my preference, but I know that it would freak me the fuck out. And the other thing, Ben, is how did we never have this conversation with Chez?
I talked to him about this once, and he was very blasé about the whole thing. He was like, really? Oh, yeah. Yeah. He didn't really seem to be all that.
So that's like a Tuesday for me.
Yeah, that was like Chez's. Yeah, that was after his morning coffee or something. That's what.
Oh, man. Okay, well, the newsletter is called thebanter.substack.com. Link in the description at bobsesca.com, of course, right under this podcast. And, of course, speaking of podcasts, the Banter podcast continues on. We record between me and Ben and Justin Rosario every Thursday, and the show goes up on Fridays. And then, of course, full disclosure, I publish an article on the Banter every Thursday morning. Meantime, make sure to follow Ben at The Daily Banter on Twitter. Okay, well, thank you so much, my friend, for supporting my work all these years. It's meant the world to me. I can't tell you how grateful I am. So thank you again.
Back at you, my friend. I appreciate it, man. And thanks for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.